Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast for the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Gerritsen. Today, my guest is Dr. Kirk Spuds Vogel, and he is the Director of Space Architectures in the Office of the Administrator at NASA Headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dr. Vogel comes to NASA with over 32 years of U.S. government service, primarily in the Department of Defense as a technical leader, senior program manager, and chief technologist. Prior to arriving at NASA, Dr. Vogel served 6 years, which, by the way, is a significant amount of time, at the Defense Advanced Projects Agency, DARPA, where he led innovative research in stealth technology, electronic warfare, airspace integration, and space control systems. He managed a portfolio of classified, state-of-the-art, high-risk programs that span multiple DARPA offices, including the Tactical Technology Office, TTO, and the Strategic Technology Office, STO. Before joining DARPA, Dr. Vogel led research and development efforts at the Air Force Research Laboratory's Technology Office, where he directed the Defense Department's only science and technology portfolio and corresponding national tech base for a highly classified mission. He oversaw 35 emerging technology areas with the goal of protecting the Department of Defense's most valuable weapons system, and he also served as the acting chief technologist for the National Reconnaissance Office's Survivability Assurance Office, or NRO-SAO. Dr. Vogel retired from active duty in 2010 after serving 21 years as an Air Force officer in both air and space domains. He was the 8th officer to lead the U.S. Air Force Red Team, when the Red Team was the first to incorporate the space domain into a nationally recognized team charter. He graduated from the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School and has flown over 40 types of aircraft. And he was the Chief Technology Officer for the Next Generation Bomber Program and led the Production Acceptance Program of the B-2s. He's done a variety of assignments in U.S. foreign policy initiatives, flight tests, space test and operations, spacecraft design, orbital dynamics, and presidentially directed research and development programs. So, Dr. Vogel, welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast.
Thank you very much, Peter. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start. Describe your role in the space ecosystem today.
So you mentioned in my background, thank you for that kind introduction. You know, I came here around the same time that Pam Melroy took over her position as the deputy administrator at NASA. She and I met while we were at DARPA. And a couple days before her own swearing in into her position as deputy administrator, she gave me a call. She knew my time at DARPA was coming to a close. They extended me as long as they could. I was there for about 6 years, and then I hit a limit. You have to leave after, you know, DARPA does not like to make an empire out of things with people's careers. So you go there for a while, they squeeze your brain for ideas, and then you move on. And Pam knew I was coming to the end of that tenure, and so she called me up and said, hey, we've got an idea over here. She wanted me to come over and put an external set of eyes on what we were doing with specifically Moon to Mars, but more generally speaking, some of the other space architectures at NASA. And so she made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And so I came over to DARPA in the summer of 21, 2 summers ago. And the position was created the Director of Space Architecture. And really what that means is I help integrate NASA's strategic engagement efforts to support the administrator and the deputy administrator, and then also act as a source for a Federated Board strategic direction. What is the Federated Board? That's sort of one of the hats I wear as I chair NASA's Cross-Directorate Federated Board. That Federated Board actually started in 2019 under the previous administrator as a memo written out to the agency, where senior leadership, really the deputies of all the mission directorates at NASA, formed this cross-directorate body to ensure priorities and general architecture direction were tightly and efficiently integrated. The thought was, rather than just sign out as a memo, they asked the Federated Board to kind of retool itself a little bit, add some structured vetting functions and some streamlined advisory functions to the Executive Council, and form a charter. So that's what we did last year. The beginning of the year is we formed in the beginning of 2022. wrote up that charter, expanded the board a little bit. It used to include only at the time the Human Exploration Office, mission directorates, as well as SMD and STMD, the Science Mission Directorate and the Space Technologies. Well, when HEO, or Human Exploration, broke up last year, divided up into ESDMD and SOMD, the Space Operations Missions Directorate, now that's two new bodies on the Federated Board, but we also added Aeronautics as well, ARMD. So there are five mission directorates sitting on the Federated Board. I chair it. And as I said before, this is, you know, the whole function of the Federated Board is to drive consensus, promote conflict resolution, help interpret strategic guidance and expectations from agency leadership, and then in turn provide advice back to the mission directors, as well as the agency leadership as well, including the governance councils.
Just to pause there for a moment, right?
Sure.
You know, for my listeners who may not be familiar with NASA's organization, is there a secret decoder ring to explain what do these different directorates do, and you know, what is the division of responsibilities among them, and how do they correlate or not correlate with the NASA centers?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. NASA's organization is structured in two different ways. Think of it as a matrix, if you will. You've got the mission directorates that are led by here at the headquarters in Washington, D.C. And those mission directorates, I just mentioned the five big ones, you know, the five main mission directorates. ARMD is the Aeronautics Research Mission Directorate. SOMD is the Space Operations Mission Directorate. That's the folks that are doing the shuttle, the communications, kind of thing, all the principal operations end of it, the pointy end of it, if you will, if you're using the DoD vernacular. The Exploration Systems Development Mission Directorate, that is led by Jim Free. That's who most people have probably heard from lately, especially with Artemis, that they're responsible for crafting all the new systems that are under development in the human exploration going forward. Science Mission Directorate is responsible for science. And so when you hear about the various rover programs or James Webb, that's all coming out of the Science Mission Directorate. And then Space Technologies Mission Directorate, think of that for those that, again, speak the language with TRL, technology readiness level. These are the folks doing the low TRL activities. They're building all the independent elements that need to be transitioned into programs of the future. So they start, the tech development folks in space technologies, they're the folks that are doing, they have an entire balance of technologies they're looking at, anywhere from the low TRL conceptual ideas. They're envisioning ideas, we call it 10% crazy, right? What's that 10% of the things that, the ideas that people aren't even beginning to think about? If you speak TRL, it's TRL 1, you know, the low stuff, all the way up to TRL 6, 7, where you've got a prototype, and then eventually that gets transitioned into programs of record. That's the similar playbook that you'd see in other agencies, such as the Department of Defense, where you've got tech development that needs to happen. In fact, I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But those are the main directorates. They're the deputies. Each one of those mission directorates is led by an associate administrator who's director of that directorate. That's the kind of, think of that as the mission side of things. They're directing how activities will happen in those particular areas. Cross-reference that with the centers. And centers are the different locations throughout the country. We have 10 of them. If you also include JPL as a FFRDC out in California, there are 10 centers that are actually executing on all of this activity. And it's not as though one center is tied to a particular mission directorate. Most of the folks that are at these centers have responsibilities that are supporting the activities that are going on in multiple directorates. And you could go on the web, I won't list them all out, but you can see there's some that, you know, focus in some areas more than others. But that's just sort of the healthy balance that exists across NASA. I would say that the way to explain that, if you think in terms of an old military way of looking at it, if your audience understands the military vernacular, it would be the supported commanders versus the supporting commanders, right? So you've got the mission directorates who are the supported commanders, and the center directors are the supporting commanders.
All right, so I interrupted. You were talking about your role in the ecosystem. And we're sort of getting to the board that was supposed to sort of equalize or seek consensus among these.
Yes. Yeah, so that's the idea, is that what happened in November of 2021, our associate administrator, Bob Cabana, and our deputy administrator, Pam Melroy, brought the Federated Board together, gave them the direction to kind of modify what they were doing with the Federated Board, form this charter, add more of a structured vetting process and advisory function into that charter, and then gave them a task. Actually brought in the mission directors whose representatives were on the Federated Board and said, this is what we want to do. Going forward, we're going to pivot. I'm going to talk about this in a moment as well, but we're going to pivot to a more of a strategic objective-based approach to Moon to Mars. And so that was when the Federated Board got the new look of this Federated Board got its new assignment, which was to go out and craft, to develop and reach consensus on a new set of objectives. And I'll explain all that. But at the same time that that direction was given, Pam looked at me and she said, and we're now installing a chair on the Federated Board and you're it. And that was sort of at the blessing of all the mission directors as well. So on one hand, I help with the agency strategy and space architectures, advising the front office, the administrator, deputy administrator, and associate administrator. But I wear this other hat as the Federated Board Chair. And so I kind of act as a facilitator for all of those deputies to have these lively conversations where we're talking about, you know, reaching consensus and resolving conflicts and whatnot. And because we're not a decision-making body, there's a lot of freedom. We enjoy a modicum of good faith that we can kind of talk about things in a closed environment, and people can speak freely, and we don't have to worry about some of that gristle and the bloodletting happening in public.
So, you know, by analogy, is this like a joint staff J5 function? Is this like a joint vision document?
Yeah, it's a blend of like a joint staff, as well as if you blended that with a SAB function, right? It's a strange thing, but there are members of this board that often the things we're looking at, they're represented. We're usually looking at some element of what's going on in the architecture. It's owned by somebody that's represented on the board. So it's not quite like a SAB, but it's similar to that.
So the joint staff, when it puts out its plans or visions, they're not decision-making in the sense of how a service actually spends their budget, but it's highly influential. But I wanted to ask about this specific document, which I'm a huge fan of. I just think the Moon to Mars objectives is pretty much as good as it gets. But am I right that this is something fundamentally new?
Absolutely. No, that's a really good observation. And thanks for the vote of confidence with it. I mean, this is a new look, and there's a reason for it. It's funny, you know, when I got here, I said, all right, Pam, I've had plenty of partnerships with NASA over my 3 decades over in the DOD, but I've never been a NASA badged person. So I'm going to do what I usually tell anybody who comes to work for me. I'm not going to make any statements for 3 months. I'm just going to ask questions. And she said, we don't have that kind of time. So she said, no, let's take a look. So it was really nice because, you know, getting to kind of get to meet folks from the top down and then get out into the various technical areas to meet folks and ask questions and get a sense of the culture over here at NASA. It was very eye-opening. But I got to say, it also didn't take but a couple, two, 3 weeks before I realized quickly in talking with Pam, we were meeting routinely about what was really going on and one way that we could actually look at a new pivot, a new way of doing business. And that's what was originally proposed to the mission directorates through this Federated Board. Everyone said they liked the idea, and we pressed off on this. And well, what is this new idea? Well, to talk about the new idea, you have to kind of go back and look at a little bit of history. And so I spent some of that early time harvesting just that. Let's go back and look at NASA's history. And some of it I was familiar with, but some of it I wasn't. And I want to say, too, the first thing that struck me when I sat down is I was expecting one consolidated binder just plopped on my desk, review that, and let's see what we think. Well, that's not what we had. We had several architectures, we'll say, none of them wrong, all of them good stuff, but we had a lot of individual takes on what the architecture was. Well, why was that? Well, when you peel back, you say, okay, well, let's just start at the beginning. Let's look at systems engineering. And so I just came from DARPA. You know, at DARPA, there's a systems engineering process called the Hellmeyer Catechism. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with it. The Hellmeyer Catechism started in the 70s with George Hellmeyer, who was the DARPA director back in the day. And it was a robust series of questions to ask somebody who is proposing a new concept for a new program at DARPA, right? And the first question in that Hellmeyer Catechism, it's basically systems engineering, but it's just broken out the way DARPA looks at it. And the first question in the Hellmeyer Catechism is, what problem are you trying to solve? Or what are you trying to accomplish? And don't use any jargon. Just speak plainly what you're trying to do. And while your listeners may have seen this, we'd put out a video back in May when we first started coming out with this. I said it in this video as well, but while NASA isn't solving a problem per se, we still have to ask ourselves at the beginning of the systems engineering process, what are we trying to do? And for NASA and human exploration, that started with why. Why are we doing this? Right? And so when you take a step back and think through that, well, why are we doing this? Why are we going? Why are we sending humans into space? Why are we going beyond LEO? You ask 100 people, and you're going to get 100 different answers. And those 100 different answers, or combinations of different answers, are going to be wide and varied. And in some cases, they might be polar opposites of one person. You ask one person, you get one answer. They might say it's this science aspect, or you're going to ask somebody else, they're going to say, no, it's a global influence. It's international partnerships. It's setting norms. You ask other people, they're going to say it's careers. It's exploration. It's human nature to explore. You ask somebody else, they're going to say it's about the economy, the human condition, leadership, advancing science and technology priorities. As you can see, you could go on and on. So that's the first step. And we said, okay, have we done that yet? Have we actually gone back and really asked that question? Let's start at the beginning. And so we did that. And we kind of formed this Venn diagram that you may have seen. You certainly will see it in this in the documents that are about to be published here in the next, we hope. It'll be out, the more detailed version will be out here soon, we hope, within the next week or two. But those why, the answer to why go, all of those wide and varied answers kind of fell into three different buckets. There's a science bucket and all the subsections that fall under that: human research, heliophysics, astrophysics, biology, physical sciences, planetary. There's a national posture bucket where we think about not just our own country, but also our relationship with other countries and international relationships and global influence, setting norms, that kind of thing. And then there's the inspirational piece of this, the stuff that's the really fuzzy stuff that really gets people motivated, though, and really, it sparks the imagination for everybody, young and old. It's about careers and STEM, preserving humanity, cultural enrichment, and then the things that get into leadership and exploration and the human condition. So there's a good argument to say you could talk to a whole bunch of folks, but at the end of the day, there's going to be somewhere on that wheel that there's people in our country who are paying the bills that said, this is what motivates us. This is why we should go do that. And then those three pillars of why we do this then form a pedestal, a foundation for that systems engineering process, upon which we then need to say, okay, with that being the why, now what do we want to go do? And that's the next crucial step in the systems engineering process. And that was where Pam and Bob, the deputy administrator and the associate administrator, came to the mission directors through their federated board reps and said, now let's flesh out the what. Let's determine the what. What are we looking to do? And it's important then that as we kind of transition into the, you know, what we're trying to do, we look at the three critical elements of what the characteristics of that what. Right? You can't just be arbitrary and you can't change it from time to time. So what are we saying? The what in any good systems engineering process should be identified with rigor. It should be developed almost by the very people who are going to go execute to say, this is the art of the possible. Here's what can be done, right? And maybe in some cases with a little bit of extra work, here's what we can go do. So it needs to be developed rigorously. It needs to be identified or established with sufficient detail such that you know how to judge success. You don't want it to be very broad, because if it's too broad, then anybody's solution path could be envisioned as a way to get to that what, and you'll end up kind of meandering a little bit. And then, of course, as I mentioned, it has to be consistent. It can't be changing all the time. So one of the things that plagues that has historically plagued NASA in the past. When you go all the way back to a time frame when you and I were at the Air Force Academy, President Bush 41 in 1989 established the Space Exploration Initiative. That's where, you know, the whole moon to Mars, you know, really kind of started to get some legs. We started talking about that. Well, that was 33 years ago. What's happened since then, though, is we've been on a little bit of a roller coaster along the way. And as administrations change out, that motivation might change. That what that we put on top might be changing from time to time because people maybe be responding to different parts of that why Venn diagram. And so as we keep changing it every 4 to 8 years, it makes it really difficult to satisfy the what. So besides being rigorous and detailed, we have to be consistent in what we're being asked to go do. And so that was a big thing. And so what Deputy Administrator Melroy did was she said, she proposed that the what we're going to go do starts with a very far-reaching aspirational goal. And it goes beyond just the camps of let's go to the moon or let's go to Mars. And already, you know, in this community, there are people who kind of fall on one of those two sides. Generally speaking, there's people that are very, hey, we're going to the moon. And that's, we're going to go to the moon and we're going to sustain ourselves at the moon. And we're going to be there for a long time. And that's it. Don't worry. Mars is too far out of reach. Or you got the folks that are very focused on Mars and say, do the minimum at the moon. Or maybe don't even do the moon and go on to Mars. Well, Pam is suggesting that it's neither of those things. It's both of them, actually. It's not that it's neither, it's that it's both. That we're not just going to the moon and we're not just going to Mars. What we're doing in the moon to Mars endeavor is we're creating a blueprint or a framework for sustained human presence and exploration throughout the solar system. We're looking beyond Mars, where Mars is just an initial campaign to demonstrate this blueprint. And the moon, in part, is a place to practice what we're going to go do on Mars. But ultimately, the vision is going to go take us beyond Mars. You know, whatever's next after that, Titan, Europa, what have you. And so that task that came back to the Federated Board in the fall of 2021 is, let's talk about that goal. Let's make sure that's the right long-term goal, this blueprint, we call it the blueprint objective. Create a blueprint for sustained human presence and exploration throughout the solar system. After some debate and whatnot, we realized that, yep, that's the right answer. But then she took that challenge further. She said, okay, now with that being the rightmost goal and knowing that Spuds is about to tell you we're going to architect from the right, I'll get to that in a minute, but what are those first top level goals as we kind of start architecting and we build back going from right to left? What are those first top level sets of goals and objectives that we need to plug in, that we need to accomplish in order to build this blueprint for sustained human presence and exploration throughout the solar system? And so that was the task, the specific task that was given to the Federated Board members way back in the fall of 2021, in addition to refining their charter. And so I want to take a step back though, Peter, and just say, you know, when you go back and look at that history again, with, you know, what generated the need to pivot? Well, because that roller coaster I had mentioned, this roller coaster ride that NASA and its partners have been on for 30 plus years, I think it was motivated by a number of things. Some of it comes from external influences. For example, I already mentioned if the what keeps changing, that's going to be a difficult task to satisfy that what. If it's too broad, if you don't put a fine enough point on it, it's going to be very hard to satisfy. But also has to come with, in a good systems engineering program, you take the what and you shift over, when you shift over from what to how, and you say, okay, here, you take the professionals that are going to go execute this, that are going to define the elements to flesh out the what. They're going to actually set up a wireframe to build that blueprint out and establish what those top level goals and objectives are and keep building it out as you move from right to left. You've got to be funded to do it as well. So there's some things that can break down in that process and the how part of this and going to make it happen. If you're not sufficiently funded, which I believe, you know, NASA has had its ups and downs in that regard, well, then you've now turned a very large, long-term, aspirational effort and you've turned it into a level of effort program. Now you're just biting off at pieces of the project, of the program, but you're not getting anywhere in particular in earnest because you're just living with what you can do. And actually, level of effort then kind of does shift you into this need to do a capabilities-based framework. And that's okay for portfolios of programs that that's what they do. They're designed to be level of effort. But an aspirational program such as Moon to Mars, human exploration, that can't be capabilities-based to fully meet the intent of what you're trying to do.
So just to pause here, because I'm basically the first page, it contrasts the difference between a capabilities-based approach and an objectives-based approach. And could you just draw those out? What is that distinction?
Yeah, absolutely. So I liken it to if you got up in your living room and decided one day, you said, you know what? I need a new chair. I need a new rocking chair. So you'd go out, you'd actually, before you even go out to your garage, you'd sit down at your kitchen table and you kind of write out everything I need to make a rocking chair. You'd figure out all the materials you need, the tools you need, et cetera. Then you go out to the garage, take stock of what you have. And then if you didn't have, you have 80% of what you need to do the job. All right, I need to go take a trip to the hardware store to go get the rest of what I need. And then you're off building your rocking chair. If on the other hand, you get up from your living room and say, I wonder what I can build today. You go out to the garage, see what you have at your disposal. That is capabilities based. That's saying, what can I do with the resources I have? Well, I can make a footstool. So you get about the task of making a footstool. Of course, that's not what you needed though. And that's not what you really wanted to do to begin with. Capabilities based is, given the resources I've got, what can I do? As opposed to the objective based, which is, I've got a goal in mind. What do I need to do to get to that goal? So how did that apply in Moon to Mars? Well, the capabilities based was part of that in response to when Constellation got canceled. There was a huge ripple of effect. You know, I mentioned the roller coaster. One of the big downturns in that roller coaster was when Constellation got canceled some 10, 15 years ago. And when that happened, the pivot for the agency at the time said, okay, we're resource limited. Let's shift into a capabilities-based approach, meaning let's go build these capabilities. And there's nothing wrong with it, right? We still did the kinds of things that we needed to do. We need a rocket. We need an Orion. We need the ground systems. We set ourselves up with all the capabilities we needed and then said, wherever they send us, we'll be ready, right? The problem is in the finer points of that, as we then get to the pointy end of getting to where we want to go and get there in earnest, that's when you run into snags. As you start to integrate these things together, it takes longer under a capabilities-based framework. And that may have been okay. And when you look at the storied history of NASA, we probably could keep doing that if there wasn't something pressing us. But, you know, one of the things that to consider is that we are a little bit more pressed now. And so we cannot take a pedestrian pace at doing this. If we really want to get to this goal, we probably need to move out on that. So that's why.
What's pressing you? I mean, what is the pressure that's driving NASA today?
Well, let's look at it. I mean, from the standpoint of, this is, again, one of those, where we are right now is an inflection point. Right? Things are a bit different. And one of the contributing factors in that inflection point is, look what's going on around us. You know, for quite some time, NASA was the only game in town. And we've got partners, both industry and international partners, that are eager to accomplish this task with us, which is fantastic, right? There's an old African proverb, I believe Pam is the one that told me about this, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with friends. And so this is about going with friends. And so the interesting thing that there are other folks that are providing competition for us right now. Some of it is international that says that they've got their own way that they want to go about doing it. And that's okay. But, you know, we're the way we're approaching the moon is a little bit different than we approached the moon in the 60s. For starters, the moon didn't change. We did. Right? The technology's different now. What we know about the moon is a little bit different, but you know, where we want to go on the moon is different. There's some really special areas on the South Pole that we'd like to investigate. So, you know, we do get into things like, and we're grateful for things like the Artemis Accords that helps us establish standards and of behavior and whatnot, and how we're going to participate with our friends going there. But what if there's competition? So I don't want to speak, you know, put too fine a point on it, but I will say that competition probably wasn't there when the whole idea of SCI started, you know, 30 years ago. It was just the aspirational goal of United States and its allies. Let's go forward. Let's go forward and do this from a humanity standpoint. Now it's starting to, you know, there's starting to be a little bit more competitive edge. I would say too, also consider that just from a public standpoint, our industry partners are enjoying a lot more success. They're getting engaged. The work done by our industry partners is more routine now. And so the fact that they are part of what we are doing is super important. I will say though, what differentiates what we're doing at NASA, you can go all the way back to that Y Venn diagram. What makes us different? Why are we different than, say, some of our international competitors? Or why are we different maybe than one or two or more of our industry partners who might be doing their own thing? Well, go back to that Y Venn diagram. NASA is the only, we're the steward of U.S. taxpayer dollars, right? And so when you go and look at that Y Venn diagram, we're the only place that's really responsible for that entire landscape.
So just to pause there, right, I want to reflect on how happy I personally was with some of the things that I think were really novel expressions of the agency that I hadn't heard from in a while. And I often have time to reflect back and look at the original NASA charter, you know, which reads, by the way, the very opening sentence says, the Congress declares that the welfare and security of the United States require that adequate provision be made for aeronautical and space activity. The Congress further declares that such activities shall be the responsibility of and shall be directed by a civilian agency. And I think that's you know, truly telling, because I think that there are many ways in which what NASA does is fundamentally improving, you used the word posture, national posture, but you know, it improves our security in peacetime. And one of the things that I was super gratified to see was on your cross-cutting objectives on the RT9, commerce and space development foster the expansion of the economic sphere beyond Earth orbit to support U.S. industry and innovation. There are a number of things in this document that I think hint at a much broader national posture role than purely exploration. Do you want to get into any of those?
I will say that there's, on RT9 in particular, right, emphasizing the importance of supporting industry efforts to both develop innovative solutions to campaign needs and to lay the groundwork for expanding the capabilities demonstrated by and developed for the Moon to Mars activities, right? That's sort of a big chunk of what's behind RT9, but I will tell you, I don't disagree. In fact, Pam would be one of the first people to say that there are, in that bubble, in that national posture part of the Venn diagram, it's inescapable that there would be some national security type of impacts or implications, but that's not what NASA does. But for those people that are concerned about those types of things, the fact that we've got a civilian organization in turn led by a civilian, you know, we've got a civilian executive office as well. It's driven by civilians. And while our motivation is purely for civil uses, there is going to be indirect benefits or impacts, I should say, implications, probably the best word, to national security as part of the national posture. And that would be true of any of our partners that participate with us. They're probably going to feel the same way about their countries, right?
Yeah. Competitiveness, international partnerships, you know, rule-based order. You know, I also, you noted at the very end, like the explanation of utilization contains not just the traditional research, test and evaluation and public outreach, but also industrialization. And in fact, you see this throughout, in particular, you know, when I look at the lunar infrastructure objectives, which even that, the whole idea of space infrastructure, you know, is something that to be in this kind of high level NASA document, I think is a true step forward.
I appreciate you saying that. There was a lot of work that came in from that original release of the 45 objectives back in May of last year. Through all the washing we did, we solicited inputs from public, industry, academia, our international partners, the NASA workforce. We got over 5,000 inputs on those objectives. And we were not just looking for validation of what we had done through the Federated Board. We were looking for changes for things that we needed to do to make it right. And I got to tell you, we got a lot of responses. We got over 5,000 inputs and we took them all in and we had to scrub on all of them. And two of the areas that changed the most was science and infrastructure. We completely re-indexed science, including created the way we repackaged it with the goals, created two new areas as well. The infrastructure we expanded from the original release to the final version that we ended up with. But you're exactly right. There's a lot of verbiage in there that actually covers, I mentioned before about the scope of this, that when you look just at the moon alone, there are elements in that infrastructure, lunar infrastructure in particular, as an example, that kind of capture both the sustained aspects of our desire to go back to the moon, as well as the analog activity that we need to do on the moon that helps us prepare for the initial Mars campaign. And so it covers both.
You know, I would also say that, you know, I was impressed rereading this today, the entire document, but in particular the lunar infrastructure objectives, with how consonant it is with the administration's cislunar strategy.
Yes, in fact, we've been working with the head of that body that has the responsibility for that over in the executive office of the president over there, Matt Daniels, who leads that effort. There's been a number of us here who've been working with him. You could probably see in that published strategy that NASA kind of has a prominent role in many of the areas. So we're in the process right now, actually. It would be kind of I probably don't want to go into too much detail about it because we're working through the implementation side of that that strategy as published. And so we're working through some of the aspects of that. A little early, be a little premature to talk in detail about those things. But yeah, they're tied. So what you see in the document that was already sent out after the Paris IAC, after Pam gave her talk, announcing the new revised objectives, that was back last fall. We were about to publish a more detailed document that takes that summary that you saw and flesh out a little bit more with the rationale and give the whole story that I've been telling here, about a 25, 30 page glossy. It'll be available digitally. We hope we're shooting for the first week of April. Hopefully we'll stay on that schedule. That's next week. But that'll be available with a lot more, with appendices that you can dig into and get into a lot more details to understand what was behind this strategy and the objectives and the development of those objectives and kind of what was our thinking and then how it changed and how it evolved.
And you guys actually had in-person workshops in Houston, right, with industry? Yeah,
there were four different feedback paths. One was internal. With the Federated Board, we did a gap analysis against the initial set of objectives, against looking through the lens of those objectives at current activities. We also had a workshop, as you mentioned, in Houston after we solicited online feedback from the public, from industry and academia in particular. We got a lot of feedback, and then those things that we wanted to follow up on or we needed to hear some, or we'd like to hear some more about, we invited them to join us in Houston for a couple-day workshop with that community. We also had another workshop with our international partners in London that within that month following the Houston workshop last summer, where we met with our international partners to do the same thing, get feedback from them, have these large round tables where everyone was represented. And we went through and got the surgical instruments out and just started carving these things up and getting really at the things that we wanted to, what we were really trying to say. And then we actually engaged with the NASA workforce as well through some online tools and got a lot of feedback from our own workforce as well. Now, these people have been around this thing for decades, so they've seen this. And so this was an opportunity, to be honest, Peter, this whole thing, I didn't say it at the top, but I should have, but this entire new strategy is guided by that robust systems engineering process and these five key principles. And the five key principles were to shift into an objectives-based framework, to architect from the right, come back from that objective and keep decomposing from right to left down into the actual elements. But then it gets into the things where how we interact with each other. And they are the unity of purpose, constancy of purpose, and the enhanced communication and engagement. And it's that last one, enhanced communication engagement, why it was so important that we did those feedback paths last summer, and why things like this podcast are very helpful to us, because this is all about engaging with our stakeholders, with each other, with the public, with our partners, because the worst thing we could do is develop that wireframe, realize we don't have enough funding to do everything we need to do right now. So we start populating parts of that wireframe, but then have that wireframe up and disappear on us. So then you end up with this cloud pattern of things that doesn't frame it all together and show folks what the overall plan is, so that when more fruitful days come and we get the budget we really need to get this done, you know, it won't be, people won't be left guessing what's going on or what their role is in all this.
Yeah. I want to say, I think that process, you know, certainly looks to me from the community, you know, that I'm in to be a very successful way of doing business, because the document appears in the zeitgeist, right? It doesn't appear tone deaf. You know, it's saying a lot of things that in particular the space advocacy community has really hoped to hear out of NASA for a long time. And it's phenomenal, you know, to see, you know, lunar power generation capable of scaling, you know, to see the prominence of the communications and lunar positioning and navigation and timing, and then to see on multiple lines, you know, a robust lunar economy, as well as what folks have been calling for forever, which is industrial scale ISRU and advanced manufacturing and autonomous construction. I mean, those are definitely things that the space advocacy community has been, you know, crying for decades, and have never received this level of prominence in, you know, a NASA strategic plan.
Well, I tell you, I think maybe part of that, at least for the last decade and a half, was probably born out from the fact that we were still in that capabilities-based mind. There would have been nothing motivating us, being all of us, not just NASA, I mean, us collectively, the people who are fans of this mission area, there was nothing motivating us to talk to it, because we were living in the now. We were constantly living in the now based on how budgets were falling out. So this was an opportunity to stop. You'll notice, for example, none of these objectives, it was a point that we made in doing this. There are no metrics in these. They're very top level. Think of this as like the technical decadal, like the science community has the decadal where every 10 years, the community, the entire science community comes together to determine what the goals should be for the next decade. Well, these objectives, these 63 objectives and the nine recurring tenets should be something that if we look back 10 years from now, we've defined them broadly, yet sufficiently and robustly, rigorously, that you could go back and look 10 years from now and are like, yep, they're still the same ones. They're still the same ones. These are the things we need to be pursuing. It's only as you start to decompose and look into the how we're going about doing that where you're going to get different solutions. And you might have new technology insights that come along that might bring you down a new path. Okay, great. So the architecture might evolve over time. But part of that third principle of constancy of purpose, which is stick to the plan, doesn't mean that we're not willing to budge on the plan. It means that if a new technical insight comes along that might give us a new idea of how to approach a particular objective, that whatever change we put into the architecture, that we put it through the same rigorous ringer, if you will, that we put these original objectives through, that we put that rigor into the process along the way, that we don't just arbitrarily make changes to our architecture, that we've got these goals and these objectives in our sight picture, like a farmer when they plow a field, right? The way they make the straight lines is they don't look right in front of them. They look all the way across the field to make the straight line.
So on that note, you know, I have an idea of how we use strategic documents in the DoD, but how does a document like this actually get used in NASA, and how does it exert its influence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So as far as I know, this is fairly unique. NASA has done things like this in the past. back in the day, the Constellation program was had its foundations in a guiding body of work that the agency did before that, that program was canceled. And in fact, a lot of what we're doing here, this isn't made up things. There's a lot of work over those last three decades that went into informing what these objectives needed to be. And so I would say there's examples in NASA's past of how these guiding documents work, but I'll tell you the way it works today sort of does leverage a bit of what we're doing with the Federated Board, is that there's a number of governance bodies here at NASA that's ultimately going to keep us focused on where we're supposed to go. So that's the leadership, that's the administrator's office. But there are bodies like the Federated Board that helps not only communicate this document and interpret what it is and kind of help the mission directorates and the centers kind of harken back to this, but it also acts as an advisory and a look to kind of do the occasional gap analysis. One of the ways this document is being used, for example, is there is a yearly review cycle that the Exploration Systems Development Mission Directorate under Jim Free, ESDMD, they are the lead and have the responsibility for the implementation of this strategy. This document that we're talking about is the strategy and the objectives development, okay? But then ESDMD has the responsibility for the implementation of that strategy and the development of the architecture, i.e. architecting from the right, and keep decomposing as you come from right to left. So they have this annual cycle that they are on for an architecture concept review that we all sit on. The members of the Federated Board are on it, as well as basically the leadership of the agency, the center directors or their reps. You name the key offices in NASA, and they're probably on this architecture concept review. And so they're on an annual cycle. We just had the first one with this new architecture using this strategy as a guidepost. They did their first one, the first architecture concept review in January, the results of which is going to form this architecture description document, I think, ADD. That's going to get published a couple weeks after this strategy document gets published. So right around the time of Space Symposium, Pam, I think, is going to make some announcements, and there should be, I'm hoping, there might be something out there to talk about this architecture description document. And that will be refined and updated on an annual basis on the cadence of these ACRs, these architecture concept reviews. So there is a washing process. Oh, go ahead.
So this becomes something of a fitness function against which systems and presumably budget too? Does this get held up like you would justify on a rapid slide in the DoD? Or
boy, I would like to think that that's where this goes. Absolutely, that's the way it should be. As it's certainly going to be a guidepost, a view screen through which they will look at their architecture every year, at those objectives, and say, how are we doing against those? And you're not going to meet everything. You know, again, it's limited budget, so we're going to do what we can and try and bite off as we go, but we'll be able to grade ourselves against these objectives for sure. As it relates to the budget, different, that's a separate process. But yeah, my view of this is it should all be interrelated, and you should be able to make a direct correlation and say, here's how we're doing. I mean, one of the things we're working on now this year with the Federated Board is at the same time that we're publishing this document for everybody, one of the next steps that I've got with the Executive Secretariat part of the Federated Board that works with me on the administrative side of the Federated Board is now map the objectives to the whys, to the elements on that Y Venn diagram. And so while we do that this summer, over the next few months, at the same time that ESDMD is building out the architecture, architecting from the right, from the objectives all the way back into elements, what that's going to give us is a forensic path from any element, any activity going on at NASA, no matter where you are, all the way through the objectives to the whys and why people would care. Why the stakeholders out there care.
I'd love to see the budget allocated towards each objective too.
That's
That'd
exactly
be very
it.
Exciting.
Absolutely. That's exactly it, because that's what's in my head is that should then have a really good influence on budget.
Yeah, I would hope it would, you know, push up your ISRU and in-space manufacturing and ISAM budgets over time. But you know, we've talked a lot about the process of this document. Do you want to say anything about its content?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way it's structured, and this is the document that is coming out here shortly, it's going to capture a lot of the things that we just talked about, gives in a little bit more treatment about kind of how we got here. So we're going to set the table a little bit with background and context of that systems engineering process and maybe some of the historical context and recent state of play. And to that end, I do want to take a real quick side comment, though, about that. One last thing about the recent state of play. I mentioned an inflection point. We have a real opportunity here. It's very rare in NESSA's history when you change, you know, as you change from one administration to the next, usually there's an overhaul. And it was interesting. This last administration change, there wasn't. We have been able to stay on the course we were on. That is unique for NASA. So all of this shifting from capabilities to a more objective-based framework and the new methodology principles that we're following, when you combine that with the fact that we were allowed to continue on the path that we were on, is a boon for this agency. And it's a real opportunity for NASA and its partners to keep moving forward with confidence in what we're doing. So we got that little bit of background and context, and then we'll go in, we describe a little bit more about the methodology principles, a little bit more treatment on that, about each one of those. If you want, there's a section that sort of introduces the objectives development, and then you can go to the appendices if you really want to dig in to some of the, you know, how we got to where we got during that washing process of last summer. But then there's a whole section, the biggest chunk of that, of this whole document, is not just the objectives themselves, broken up into science, infrastructure, transportation, habitation, and operations, the goals, but also the rationale behind all of them. And so that, I think, will be a new thing that folks haven't seen when you compare it against the just the quick publish of the executive summary we did last fall. And then a few pages on what's ahead in that process with the ACR that I mentioned. And then back in the appendices, if you want to dig into it, you can dig into we break down that Y Venn diagram, not just those three pillars, but each one of those subheadings in there. And we dig into what we mean by norms or global influences or STEM, careers, heliophysics, et cetera. You know, why those things are so motivational for the people in our country. And then there's another appendix that gets more into detail about the objectives development process and the scrubbing process. We called it the summer scrub last year. We talked about that a little bit more and the gap analysis that we did. And then there's a real long appendix, Appendix C, that'll be available on the digital version that talks from the science community. They do a really good job of mapping the decadal surveys from this last decadal into the science goals, into those science goals and objectives that were released, the 26, six science goals and 26 objectives. And we have that mapping for that. So the science community will be gratified to see that connective tissue as well, I hope.
And I noticed that you have science enabling and applied science goals, right?
Those are new.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I sure will. So for the science enabling, what this is depending, imagine if you will, we had these science objectives out there. And some of the feedback we got during the summer last year was, in some cases, we didn't have enough detail. And in some cases, we weren't detailed enough. But part of what came out of that reindexing of the science was, in some cases, it was science objectives that were built in order to help the other objectives, to help the infrastructure, to help with trans and hab, to help with operations. And we already knew there were going to be dependencies and interdependencies within these objectives. But one whole package of these science objectives was what objectives do we need specifically because they are enabling other objectives. And then there were other objectives that we put in there that we said they're purely for how we do science. Conducting science on the moon, I think the goal for applied science is about these objectives aim to show how dedicated science investigations lay the groundwork to enable other organizations to effectively design architectures or buy down risk associated with humans or robotic assets operating safely and effectively on planetary surfaces. That's the applied sciences. So that's the one that says, how do we tie into other areas? The one that talks to a certain level of infrastructure and operations must exist in order to enable discipline, all the other science discipline specific science objectives that feed into the lunar planetary sciences, the heliophysics, et cetera, the physical sciences. Those are the science enabling ones. So these are objectives. The science enabling are the objectives that say, what do we need to do that lays the groundwork just within science to do all the other science objectives that we need? And so that was a lot of feedback we got from the science community itself.
So in this last portion, I want to go big, back to the ultimate whys. So while you're thinking about that, I want to remind the listener that right now we're at a tenuous time, because while the administration has been, I think, you know, adequately generous, you know, proposing a $1.8 billion increase, which unfortunately sort of just keeps up with inflation, but it is still an increase. There are folks in Congress that are talking about a rollback to 2022 levels, which would mean a $1.4 billion cut over what they received in 2023, or even a really scary one that the NASA administrator responded to that might be a 22% cut, you know, back down to about $19.8 billion. So it's important to realize that, you know, that level of funding, the administrator said, could restructure or terminate things like Artemis IV and the Gateway. And so I think it's important now to talk about really the long-term value proposition of, you know, that NASA is offering. So fundamentally, why is space important to U.S. strategy and ambitions?
So I think I would stretch beyond what we were talking about before with just the national posture. And I'd say it does feedback. I think you already, you knew where I'd go with this, which is right back into that why Venn diagram. It hits everywhere. Right. And again, this is why, what makes it special for NASA. This is what makes us stand out, and we're a little bit different. If a particular industry partner, if the person at the top of that ladder decided they don't want to do this anymore, or they don't want, you know, whatever is motivating, I don't know if I should mention names, but a particular CEO of a company says, this is why I want to go do something. Now, keeping in mind, we want to do this together anyway. But if that person left the company, or, you know, suddenly wasn't doing this anyway, somebody else is in charge the next day, that person may not feel the same way, right? NASA is a little bit different. So we have that entire landscape of things that we say, okay, so the answer to your question is pull back and look at the details, look at Appendix A of this document that's coming out next week and read through those. And you're going to get several dozen answers to that question. Why is this? Why do we want to go do this?
What about you, you know, as somebody who's got an enormous amount of breadth looking at this field from many different angles, what do you as a citizen think it is the sort of space agenda that's worthy of our nation at this period of time? And what's your vision of where we want to go in space?
Well, I think what we want to do, I would say it's aspirational. I mean, I mentioned SCI back when we were lieutenants. I still have the poster for SCI from when I was a lieutenant. It's still sitting in my house back in Ohio. I've been motivated since I was a young man about this. So to me, it is about mankind. It's in our nature to explore. So you're asking me personally, I think it's just human nature, and it's just part of who we are. I look at it from a U.S. citizen, and I say, I want to do this because it is, there's national pride of anybody who's participating in this. This gives us an opportunity to be a part of history. You know, it's interesting. I came from the DOD, where, you know, our job was pretty specific. Not to put too fine a point on it, but our job on that side of things, Peter, you did the same thing. It's a little bit more aggressive in nature. There's a karmic shift when I came over from DOD to here. This is now, let's go find life on Mars. Let's go explore. Let's go not just learn how to survive in a domain, but let's learn how to thrive there, right? Every time history is replete with humanity. We did it just in the space example. We go into a new domain. We did it in LEO. First, you learn how to get there. You learn how to operate there. You learn how to survive. That evolves over time, and you learn how to thrive there. And then while you're learning how to build an economy surrounding that and thriving there, you also then prepare yourself for the next phase. And that's what we're doing here. That's this whole Moon to Mars enterprise, which is, we're going to do this on the moon now. We're going to learn. We're going to go back. And we're not just going to show and prove that we could do it. That harkens back to what we did in the 60s. We're going for a different reason now. We're now going because we think that there's a reason several good reasons, many of manifold reasons to go back to both stay, have a sustained presence there, and then use that as a springboard to plan for the next thing, the next domain being Mars. The domain after that will do the same. That blueprint will play out again on Mars. We're going to sustain ourselves there, and we're going to prepare for the next one as well. We'll do activities and learn from that experience. So to me, it's human nature. So why not the U.S.? We're in a leadership position, and we're taking this view screen of caring what everybody wants. We're listening to people and saying, it's not just one thing or the other. It's not just proving that we can go do it. We're not doing it for those simple reasons. We're actually, science, for example, isn't just science we're going to do while we're at it. It's more of science is driving this. Science is one of the three pillars on here of why we're doing what we're doing. So that then helps drive the architecture. And that's important. So that way, you mentioned the funding thing. When the funding doesn't quite show up on a year-to-year basis, it's okay. We've got a plan. And we're going to prioritize what we're doing and prepare for more fruitful days. And we will then be ready because the wireframe is built out. And we'll be ready for when the funding does roll in at the levels that we need to do this and be competitive.
So Dr. Vogel, thank you so much for your time today, sharing us, about the Moon and Mars objectives and the NASA internal progress, and good luck on your next steps.
Thanks very much, Peter. Thanks for having me. This is great.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.